how it was. At the end of the age of oil.
Can a city really work without oil? How will we ever make the transition? I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and you are in for a treat. Peter Newman has designed public transport in Australia and studied sustainable cities all over the world. Now we'll hear his first speech of the book tour for Resilient Cities, Responding to Peak Oil and Climate Change. The one-hour talk on January 9, 2009 was hosted by Anthony Pearl of Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. Professor Pearl is the co-author of Transportation Revolution and a driving force in new city design. In this speech, Peter Newman acknowledges the possibility of city crash, the Mad Max movie scenario, as oil and the climate decline. Perhaps the rich will retire behind armed eco-friendly barracks. But Newman sees a better way out. I dared to hope after hearing him. The place was packed to standing room only, mostly with young people. So good to see. There was a definite buzz.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Simon Fraser's Vancouver campus. It's great to see so many people out on a Friday night to hear North American premiere of a very important presentation and a very important piece of work. Peter Newman from Curtin University in Perth, Western Australia, is almost fresh off the plane here to join us tonight on the beginning of what will be a major North American tour to change the way planning and cities are thought about at a time when a lot of ideas, old ideas, are up for grabs. So it's great timing to have this opportunity for a book launch here at Simon Fraser. Peter is someone who is probably well known, I know, to many people in the room. I won't give him a big formal introduction, but just to say that he is one of the leaders in terms of thinking about cities and sustainability in the world. He's someone who has been working and thinking and doing very important things about building links and connections between energy, environment, and urbanism for a number of decades. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Peter Newman to Simon Fraser University.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be here. Yeah, it's great to see faces that I've seen before and people who I have worked with over those many decades. And this is a special time because this book is 30 years in the making, and this is the first presentation of it. I only had a few copies of it until just a few days ago. I'm starting a nine-city tour across the US, but I thought I'd start in Vancouver because it really was born here in the sense that Anthony put on a seminar which brought me together with Tim Beatley, and it was about climate change and peak oil. And we started writing together at that point, and we ended up with this book. So I thought it'd be good to start here. But I'm from Perth, the Swan River colony, home of the Black Swan. Have you heard about this book, The Black Swan? I only recently heard about it. It's our contribution to the world of philosophy, it seems. The Black Swan was discovered in 1698 by a Dutch explorer called Vlaming, who sailed up what's now called the Swan River, and discovered that, to his amazement, that swans could be black. Up until that time, swans were always white, and it was never considered possible that a swan could be black. And so this man has written a book which talks about black swans, the unpredictable, the past doesn't help you to be a guide to the future. And in my sense, the black swans can be things of fear or hope. And I think the things that I want to talk about tonight, climate change, peak oil, and the crash, are all black swans, but perhaps should have been predicted. And how we respond to them in our cities is what we're talking about. So the book is called Resilient Cities, Responding to Peak Oil and Climate Change. And
we also have this other book that Tim wrote and which I helped him on, called Green Urbanism Down Under. We have a website, resilientcitiesbook.org, and there's a whole lot of extra material on that, including this PowerPoint. So that's Tim and I when we came to Vancouver and went around the place on our electric bikes. So climate change, of course, we all now know about. It's no longer the black swan, but it is something that is quite scary as we see the rapid change, the loss of Arctic sea ice and so on, that is beginning to work its way through political consciousness. In Perth, we now have half the rainfall that we normally had, and we have adjusted to that. In the last 20 years, the water authorities have said we are no longer going to have average rainfall. It is now half what it was, and that is the new norm, and that is climate change that has produced it. We are one of the areas that were predicted to be first affected by climate change, and it is happening. Other places have got a lot more water, and clearly cities are affected by climate change. The interesting thing is to see how it is now becoming part of global governance. Everybody is saying 50 to 80% less greenhouse gases by 2050. That's the global commitment, and in Copenhagen next year, the world's authorities will come up with how to do that, or the next steps anyway. It's a kind of glib thing almost to say, well, is that going to be enough, and so on. It's such a major, dramatic change to think that we would head down that track. And so the old economy, which was built on more and more fossil fuels, is now undermined. Even though we still don't have in place the governance, the legal structures to require that. When people are investing for the next 30 years, and they see people like Obama saying that's what they want, clearly it's a different world. But we have no alternative. We have to move down that way. Nicola Stern has said in the UK report that the early action is going to be the most economically sensible thing to do. We've had our Obama experience in Australia. We threw out a very conservative government, and the new government, the very first thing they did was to sign Kyoto to join the world in this new global governance of climate change. So we have a lot of things happening. I'm on a body called Infrastructure Australia, which has $20 billion to invest in new infrastructure with climate change as one of its core requirements. How to meet that agenda. That's a whole new world when we start to move down that. But peak oil, to me, has been a more important issue in the sense that it is dramatically happening and is changing our economy now. It is simply saying there is a practical limit to the number of barrels of crude oil that can be pumped every day. Now, that was on the front of the Wall Street Journal. But it's taken 30 years to get to the point where people will even talk about it. It's a simple geophysical fact that oil fields go through a production cycle and have a peak and they go down, and that every country, every region has a point where it goes through that cycle. The US peaked in 1970. It's now 87% depleted in its own oil supplies. They still talk as though if you do some magic tweaking, suddenly the oil will be found and, you know, they'll get back to being secure again, but constantly gone down. The man who predicted that was M. King Hubbert back in 1956. He could see the black swan. He was considered mad, as I'm sure people said about Fleming. He didn't have a photograph he could bring back, but he said they're black, those swans. And this is a phenomenon now that we've had to adjust to, and increasingly people accepting. But he predicted that world oil would peak about now, and the reality is discoveries of oil have been going down. These are the countries that have all peaked in oil. The amount of oil that's left is now a constant, ongoing, contentious issue, but increasingly people are coming to seeing that kind of shape that's the basis of we've been looking at and saying, well, what does it mean for our cities? It basically means that this era of cheap oil is over. The latest reports, and these have come out since we finished the book, the UK one is a very significant report. The five mega major oil companies have all peaked, and that occurred in 2004. Now, they can go anywhere in the world to find their oil, but they're going down each year. This report says the key to peak oil is to understand that there will be extremely volatile prices, and yet the underlying trend is an increase in 6% a year in the price, and that the permanent decline, they say, would be after 2013. The CEPA index, which is about exploration and development, has doubled since 2005 because the rest of the oil is harder to get. This was the interesting one, though. The World Energy Outlook, every year, the IEA, who's the major international body looking at energy, they've essentially said peak oil, rubbish. Don't believe it. There's always more oil. It's just a question of economics. They're now very concerned. Output is declining faster than previously thought. I heard interviews with the author of this report trying desperately to cover up why it was they didn't say anything more about this before. Why did they suddenly change? And really, he couldn't explain it, but I'd say the political pressure was pretty much there. The annual rate of decline is predicted to be 9% a year. You imagine putting that into your own life, that you have to have 9% less oil use per year from here on. How would you manage? That's the way the world has to face. And we've got a whole lot of countries like China and India that aren't too keen on that idea. If we invested massively, we could make that 6% decline. We have to find a Saudi Arabia every 2 years. So there's this huge uncertainty. But what has happened in the economy is essentially that peak oil has happened. It doesn't matter when that actual physical peak occurs. It might not be for a couple of years, but it happened, and it happened in this past year. Essentially, the price rose quite dramatically, and it caused the car-dependent subprime mortgages to fold, and banks were loaning excessively based on the belief that car-based growth would always happen. So essentially, that rise in fuel tipped us over. Now, the link between peak oil and the crash is increasingly being made, but it to me it's just very, very obvious that that's what happened. And where we now sit is that we have a lack of confidence in the future because of that rise. At some time it might happen again. Then what's it going to do? What's it going to do to our new suburbs? What's it going to do to our transport systems? There is a lack of confidence, and that undermines the economy. It's very hard for people to see their way through it. But there is also a lack of confidence in alternatives to that oil, because it dropped again. It dropped to a point where it's way below any kind of economic alternative. The Canadian tar sands, the biofuels and so on, they're so much harder to produce. And now, suddenly, they're off the agenda while the price is down. So it's a difficult future, and it's even more difficult for those people who living in those areas where the mortgages had to be caused the foreclosures. It's quite common to talk about toxic loans in this area, and less to talk about what I call toxic urban scatter. We've had urban sprawl and the issues to do with suburbs going further and further out, but the areas that were really vulnerable to increased prices were what I call urban scatter. These are areas that are beyond urban boundaries. And in the US cities around Houston and Atlanta and Phoenix, these areas are just places where there is no work, there are no services, there is certainly no public transport, and they are highly vulnerable to increasing fuel prices. So whole towns, whole suburbs have been boarded up. Now, that is a terrible thing. to have happen to a city. And it's one that I just can't believe that we've got ourselves into that. And we've really got to deal with it. We can't let that sort of thing happen. We have a situation of really serious angst. The oil-based economic confidence is undermined, and deservedly, and there is real fear. We have to recognise that fear. And the word resilience is really about how we overcome that. The declines are now being seen in all the data. 4% decline in vehicle miles travelled in the US in the last year. The first time a real decline has set in. But it actually started a bit before that. So there is a social trend as well as being related to fuel. But the costs of transport, when you get very high oil prices, when it comes 60% of the cost of a container being transported is the transport fuel costs. When you get up to $150 a barrel, that means you really can't keep going. So how do we respond? This book is a positive book. It is recognising these issues, but it is trying to say there are things we can do. There are four options, as far as I can see, only four. Collapse, ruralised city, divided city, resilient city. Collapse is certainly on the agenda. If you go to the websites like lifeafterthecrash.com, dieoff.com, these are not pleasant reading. And even Oil Drum, which is much more scientific about peak oil, there are certainly a lot of people who see the future as very devastating, and that civilization as we know it will end soon, as a Republican congressman said. So collapse can happen and has. I mean, cities do collapse. Ephesus was abandoned in 1000 AD. It was the second biggest city in the Roman Empire. It collapsed because it was a port city. This road went to the port. It's now about 13 kilometres inland because they cut down all the trees in the surrounding forest and the river silted up and destroyed the city. So things can happen. Babylon collapsed in 140 BC, the great city of the ancient world. So people say, well, you know, we got no show. Everything is based on oil. It's going to all collapse. But there is increasing awareness. We've certainly seen that on climate change. Peak oil, it's happening daily. There are people who say only white swans exist. It is possible to deny it. If so, and if those cities keep saying that, they will go into a very severe decline. So some cities will do better than others. The second option is ruralised city. And some of my colleagues from Australia invented permaculture. And permaculture is a fantastic agricultural system on a small scale. But some people have made it into a philosophy and an urban philosophy, and essentially saying that cities will just become very intensive food production areas and will no longer work as cities. They'll just be essentially medieval villages where we barter and exchange. Even Matthew Symonds, the Houston banker, when asked what should we do, said start growing your own food. I think there needs to be more than that. They often use Havana as the example of the city that responded when the Soviet oil was cut off and now grows 40% of its own food. And often they say the best thing is to scatter urban areas. The suburbs are ideal for permaculture because there's plenty of space and no one will be travelling because it's just rural food production. Now, I do think that localised food production will increase, and Tim talks a lot about this, about food miles and slow food, but cities will remain as cities. The great urban experiment's not going to stop. Cities create opportunities. They are not for just bartering food, and I do think we have to reassert that cities are important. Green urbanism, title that Tim has used, means that cities are more urban and more green. They are cities, though. The third option is divided city. Wealthy eco-enclaves surrounded by Mad Max suburbs. It's worth looking at the Mad Max films again. This is another Australian contribution. George Miller, when he wrote these was aware of peak oil, and it's pretty scary stuff. But the wealthy eco-enclaves are happening, and it is highly probable that we'll get this very divided city, because the wealthy are choosing to live in good locations, good public transport, where you can walk and bike, lots of healthy food and all of those opportunities. You can buy that now. It's certainly becoming very apparent in Australian cities. But I find it in American cities as well. This is looking from a hotel in Century City, Los Angeles, down on a new development that I thought, this is a new urbanist kind of development. I must go and have a look at this. And you go down and there's an armed guard preventing you from going in. You can buy into these enclaves, of course. All of those responses to me are based on fear. And no policy based on fear ever really works. They are not resilient. So the resilient city is building a new economy in which our cities are more resilient. And there will be a lot of new things that happen. There need to be some black swans pulled out of the hat. And that has happened in the past. This is the city of hope. Now, if you look at the waves of innovation, economic theory does have these understandings which can be related to innovation, but they also can be related to city form. The first wave of innovation in industrialism, the iron, water, power, mechanisation era, that was based around the old walking cities with water-based transport linking them. And in the 1840s, there was a massive depression, and out of that came the steam power era with railroads that took those cities further out. They followed the trains, and most American cities, Australian cities, were built in that era with the steam trains and steel. In the 1890s, there was a massive depression that ended that era. And out of that came the electric era, where we had tramways, electric lights, and we were able to get rid of all the coal boilers and so on and have a much more easy city to live in, because you weren't living next to the production of that power. The first cars appeared, but they didn't shape the cities at that point. The cities were built around trams and trains. And in the 1930s, that era ended. Massive depression again. Out of that era came the car-based city with cheap oil, and the cities spread based on that new economy. It's a little harder to tell history when you're close to it, but we've had an era of the digital revolution, which has helped our cities rebuild. A lot of the old industrial areas, like in Vancouver, now been replaced with the new economy based around services and the new digital economy. But the next era, and I think it is going to come out of this collapse that we're in now, is the era of sustainability. Radical resource productivity, massive changes, the factor 4, factor 10 kind of economy, where we'll have massively less fossil fuel use. Whole system design, biomimicry, green chemistry, renewable energy, and green nanotechnology. These kind of technologies are appearing and will need to be built into the new economy. We can't go back and say that previous era, based on cheap fuel, and cars, freeways, we just have to somehow prop it up. We can't. And in the past, we've had to move on. There is a real tendency in the present environment to say, look, let's just pour money into everything to prop it up. But if we aren't clever about where we use that money, we could actually be making it worse. So the resilient city has a number of characteristics to it, and I'm not going to talk about all of them. Tim is mostly dealing with the first ones, renewable energy, carbon neutral, distributed, photosynthetic, eco-efficient and place-based city. And I, of course, talk about the sustainable transport city. But they all have this combination of digital smart technologies with the new technologies of sustainability and building in design and different systems of management, different approaches to urban life. They're not just a technological breakthrough, but they do involve technology. So what about sustainable transport? And my area is essentially to say that we have to stop building extra urban road capacity and urban scatter. The US in particular has to stop that. The US and the world can't afford to consume the resources that they take. And we have to start building electric, renewable cities with much greater localism in the economy and infrastructure, very simply. And who has to change most? The data that we collect on cities, Jeff is at the moment working on 100 cities, bringing it up to 2005. But the same patterns are really there. You see out there on the left, the American cities. I'm going to Atlanta for the first time on this trip. I'm a little bit scared of it, the great beast. But 103 gigajoules per capita is what Atlanta consumes. The average American city is in the 50s. New York's the lowest there at 46 or something. The Australian, Canadian, New Zealand cities are in that middle part, and they are around the 30 to 40 mark. And the European cities are all under 20. You can see down here, Barcelona is 8 gigajoules per capita. Just think of that, 8 compared to 103. Very, very similar levels of wealth, enormously different amount of fuel. These are the Chinese and Indian cities down here, along with places like Hong Kong and so on. But the new cities that we're supposed to be scared of are around 2 gigajoules per capita. In fact, all of the new cities in China, there's been about, how many million is it? I've forgotten the number now. It's about 200 million people have moved into Chinese cities in the last 10 or 15 years, and they are not consuming the equivalent of one Atlanta. And density is clearly related to it. The Barcelona here is 200 people per hectare. Most of the European cities are about 50-odd, and our cities are usually under 20, but Atlanta is 6 people per hectare. When you have a city like that, this is what I mean by urban scatter. It really is so hard to do anything other than service that by car. You can't do much more than that. So these are the cities that are now very vulnerable. Barcelona is not. It will survive, as many European cities will. And these areas that are being abandoned, we have to see a failed urban experiment. We've got a couple of researchers in Australia who've made vampire maps. Vampire stands for vulnerability and something about mortgages and price and fuel. But they essentially show that the red areas are very vulnerable. They use cars 10 times as much as the blue areas, 10 times per capita. The blue areas are this is Sydney. This is an extremely wealthy area. Out here in the western suburbs, 10 times the car use, much poorer. The important thing to see is the green areas that snake through the middle. That's where the rail lines are. And they have half the fuel use of those red areas. So you can make a difference. And the thing that has to stop most that has fed those red areas is the building of freeways. You can see the US cities out there. They have by far the most freeways. And you go to any American city and they're just amazing, the amount of concrete, the amount of money that has gone into building these freeways. They're just endless. And I think we will look back on them and say, you know, how did we ever do it? This is about the size of a medieval city. It's one freeway interchange.
That was Peter Newman, the Australian sustainable transportation expert and author, speaking in Vancouver January 9th. There is lots more to come. Don't go away, including a quick tour of cities making big changes and the reason why sustainable energy needs electric transportation. The rest of Peter Newman's inspiring talk coming up in just 30 seconds. Welcome to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We'll dive right back into a speech at Simon Fraser University by the Australian city design expert Peter Newman. His book is Resilient Cities, Responding to Peak Oil and Climate Change.
When you look at what they do for a city, it's not much. If you try to see how delay is being reduced by building freeways, there's no evidence of it. The Texas Transportation Institute provides all this kind of data. There is no correlation in there between delay and freeway miles. And it's really easy to see why, and essentially to recognise that the freeway is a failed technology. Cities adapt to their one-hour travel time budget. We go into that in a good deal of detail, but no matter what the infrastructure is that's provided, significantly, freeways fail as public spaces. They don't provide for us that urbanity that makes cities work. And in a post-peak oil world, they're dinosaurs. What they do to cities is essentially not good for economies or people. If you look down, this is Chicago, and you just see how much space they take. The economists have got a word for this now. They call it agglomeration diseconomies. And there is also agglomeration economies that are found when they build good rail projects that save enormous space and create opportunities for cities to work. And we're starting to find ways of bringing that into the decision-making process, but only just starting. You'll still find that benefit-cost ratios are dominated by traffic engineers who can show you why they improve the economy enormously, and yet they never evaluate that, and certainly they don't bring that into it. My interest now is to see whether we can reclaim and rehabilitate these spaces. When you see that kind of thing, if it was dug up by future archaeologists, they'll wonder what it was for, I'm sure. But that whole space could be replaced by one rail line. When you look at how much capacity there is, a freeway only carries 2,500 people down one lane in an hour. A busway, 5,000. A light rail, 10 to 20,000, and a train, 50,000. So it's a factor of 20. So you can see that space that you save, enormous amount of space. So space is money, space is urbanity, space is a good city. And of course we know that land use follows these transport patterns, and urban scatter, as I call it, is now a major issue. Now, I've got to pay tribute to a Vancouver person, when you say Vancouverite, who walked in my door a little less than a year ago and said he was looking to do some work, and he's become my right-hand researcher now, Roman Trubka. Some of his family are here. And he produced this work which looks at the costs of urban development. And it compares, if you put urban development on the fringe, to redevelopment of a kind, TOD, transit-oriented development. You would save $85,000 in Australia in infrastructure costs that are subsidised to that urban development on the fringe. And that's found right across our cities. I'm sure it's the same here. There would be an extra $250,000 in transport costs for each block over a 50-year period, and of course 4.4 tonnes per year more in greenhouse gases, and also a whole lot of health savings. That report's on our website. There are a lot of human aspects to it as well. This English study was an interesting one. They looked at the difference between kids who got taken to school by car and those who walked or who went by public transport, and they called them battery hen kids or free range kids. The battery hen kids grow up much more fearful. They don't understand their place. They don't trust strangers, and they don't develop the consequent risk-taking abilities. And free range kids, of course, do that much quicker. So there is so many issues that you can look at on that front. So the resilient city will have to stop all those things and do a lot more that is both green and urban. And I'm going to tell you what they are very quickly. Todd, Pod, Vod, God, Fev, EcoV, and TDM. Todd, you know, is transit-oriented development, and you do this as well as anyone. It is about building electric transit faster than the traffic into and across the city, and to do it with land development partnerships. It's so obvious, and yet so few cities do it. When people ask me, where can I go in the world to see these TODs? There's almost nowhere you can take them in the US. Still, despite all, you know, 20 years of talking about it, there's a few examples starting. I still say go to Vancouver. And the speed of the public transport is so critical to it all. The new Brookings report that has just come out has demonstrated that public transport is actually growing quite dramatically, and there is a decline in car use, and this actually set in before the oil price increases. So, and what they relate it to is the fact the urbanity that is drawing younger people in particular back into cities. The dramatic increases in transit that are occurring in both the US, I'm sure in Canada as well, but it's been amazing in Australian cities. All public transport across all Australian cities is full now. Infrastructure Australia was set up to try and address this. We had a 25% increase in a 10-year period, and in that 5-year period, a 13% increase. In Melbourne, it was an 18% increase in 2 years. It's extraordinary what's happened. Now, this is my story, just quickly. That's me in 1979, the young hippie trying to reverse a government decision. They closed our railway down in Perth. It was the best thing that could have happened for us, because we had a whole political movement start. It was very cathartic. 1979 was the oil crisis year, and people started to think, how can we build a city if we don't have a good rail system? So we were able to get enormous public support. That government was thrown out, and we were able to bring the train back, and then progressively, over the next 20-year period, to build our rail system up. And in many ways, we became a model for what a car-dependent city could do at a time when other car-dependent cities were doing nothing. And we have a brand new rail system now. It goes 180 kilometres. This part of it, the Southern Railway, was opened just a year ago. It was opened with enormous popular support, 90% approval ratings. And it was so popular that because we had a mining boom going on the coffers were full, they paid off the railway even before it was opened. So there's no debt on our rail system. Now, that only happens when you've got amazing political support. Otherwise, governments just give tax relief. You know, everybody wants reductions. They said, no, we're going to do that. And the public said, that's what we want. It's now carrying 50,000 a day, where there were 14,000 a day carried on the buses down that corridor. So it's been a terrific success. It runs down the middle of the freeway, and I think is a model for how you can get rail built into cities. You've done pretty well at it too. Each city is different. There's not a lot of room left to make cities have better public transport. Well, there's a lot of freeway space. And so that's one of the things we did, and it was relatively cheap. So this, you can see on the left here, going down the freeway, and the stations become the start of recolonising that freeway, because they are being built now as potential TOD sites, going over and around them and building and reclaiming that. The train goes much faster than the traffic. It goes to Mandurah, which is 80 kilometres at 130 kilometres an hour top speed, and it does that in 48 minutes, whereas a car would only do it in an hour and 10 minutes. So it's very easy to see why it will attract people, but at each of the stops, you have the chance of creating a much more urban development. Now, I don't have to tell you much about it because you've done a lot of this, but when you see it happening in Phoenix, they've taken that big wide road and put a whole new light rail system down the middle of it, and it is reclaiming that road space. These are the kind of things that any city can do. In Houston, they've got down here, they've got enormous amount of freeways. That middle structure there is entirely to get cars over and into the HOV lane. Massive amount of money to do that. But there's a group called Houston Tomorrow that is trying to see how that can be converted into a rail system and can begin to claim back those kind of spaces. Very hard to imagine, but this is the kind of black swan that has to be produced for the new kind of city. How do we reclaim those cities? And it will be political. You cannot avoid politics. All infrastructure is political. And up until now, it's been very easy just to roll out the roads. We had a Minister for Transport who's pictured here doing her work. She was amazing, and she helped to build this rail system and change the priorities from $5 on roads, $1 on rail, to $1 on roads, $5 on rail. And that was done in a city which is very car-based and won 4 elections based on it. So you can make it politically acceptable, but you've got to have leadership. And, of course, once you do that, you begin to develop the TODs. You won't get TODs properly unless you have the transit. There's now a term called TODWASH, which is where people build transit-oriented development without the transit. And there's plenty of them in the US. So there are plenty of people like G.B. Arrington from Portland who know how to do it. And PB Placemaking, that he now works in, is showing time and again that you can have 50% less car use if you live and work in those areas. The big project for me that's very symbolic for the US is Tysons Corner, a massive edge city. It's dying. The owners, the developers themselves said, we've got to redevelop this on a different model. And so they're building 3 TODs, a rail line, with 2 light rail links as well, and that's going to transform Tysons Corner in Washington, D.C. I think it'll be a very symbolic project. And Vancouver has done some great stuff. We have similar projects that are now happening here. I don't think we would have been able to do them unless we'd had some examples from Vancouver and people like Gordon Price coming over and showing us how to do it. Here's an example. The new railway goes under the city and comes out here. So this got knocked down. It's a freeway on-ramp. Everyone said how critical it was to have this freeway on-ramp, but it's disappeared and nobody even notices now because they want to put Dubai there. Now, Perth doesn't do this stuff. So it's quite remarkable that it even be imagined. It won't get built, but something will get built there and it'll be a lot better than a freeway on-ramp. And that's the kind of transformation that can happen when you change the priorities. We've done much smaller scale things like Subiaco, which are quite nice. And some of the new stations are now trying to emulate that. This is 35 kilometres from the city, as is Joondalup, which has been built as a TOD quite way out of the city. Now, an interesting one is Chatswood in Sydney. I know it's contentious talk about public-private partnerships, and it's an issue here. I believe it's a very important part of how we need to build for the future, that the private sector can help us with the capital that's needed for this kind of project. This is an example in Chatswood. The entire project of rebuilding the station here was built by the private sector in exchange for the air rights there. This is in Sydney. And that project has worked very well financially and with the local community. But you can see the kind of benefits of this high-density centre, and then all around it, suburbs that are untouched by that development, but very affected by it in the sense that they now have a good transit system, jobs, services, shops, all close by. And building them out into the suburbs is what this is all about. Now, the kind of data that I have been talking about in Vancouver, you'll have to tell me if this is still happening, but it is quite dramatic the way in which the city of Vancouver has reduced car trips and is increasing walking and cycling. And this is the kind of thing I've been talking about around the world, showing off Vancouver, and particularly since I was here a few years ago and enjoyed Coal Harbour and other areas of the city. But the importance of social housing in that mix and of your 5% requirement for social infrastructure to be part of that design. Are you still doing it? Is it still there?
Sorry.
Very important. And I think that if you can keep doing it, it means that you can create these kind of spaces. If we are going to make these dense TODs work, they've got to be well designed. And when I find these kind of places, then there's Anthony on his bike. They're very attractive. And I think you can create some real options. And this is showing some of the social housing that's part of that development. Not such a bad life in the now I'm going to move quickly. POD is pedestrian-oriented development, bicycle-oriented development is BOD. Essentially, we have to look after people on the ground as well as making all that infrastructure. And it's simple to do. Melbourne has transformed itself in its central city and won all kinds of awards because they've done a lot to make it a much more walkable city. And Jan Gehl is the architect, and he's now working in cities around the world, London, New York, Seattle, and in most of the Australian cities. The amazing thing is to see things like this happening. This freeway in Seoul covers the main river, which is a sacred river in their history, and was enormously unpopular that the freeway was built, but of course you had to do it. It's the only space left in the city. But 5 years ago, or a little over now, the Consumer Association there put candidates up for the mayoralty, and the one who said he'd take that down won the election. And you imagine him going to the traffic engineer saying, "We got to take that down." But they did it. And the result has been an extraordinary public park, a greening of the city. The traffic has disappeared. They've got some public transport that's replaced it, but mostly it's just disappeared. And it's a model, really, of the way in which a city can cope without those kind of car-based structures. Same thing happened in Aarhus, small Danish town. The Aarhus River runs underneath that arterial road. So they dug it up and created these wonderful spaces. The mayor of Aarhus goes all over Europe these days because cities say, "We want to try and find a river to dig up." London even has got amazing commitments now to, this is the Millennium Bridge, which was a pedestrian bridge, very symbolic of the new era. And this is Kensington High Road, which has been done as an example of what they call naked streets, where all the traffic signs are taken down. So drivers get confused and they slow down. There is no guidance whatsoever to the driver, and you make sure there's good wide footpaths and opportunities for cyclists. And it's, you know, those bars in London that stop pedestrians from going on the road. They're all taken down. And the accident rate has been halved. In the US, they call it complete streets, and taking out these kind of heavy highways. It is a matter of imagining the future, and that kind of future is possible. Vélib has been a dramatic example in Paris, and in Boulder we've got examples of what can be done in a small town with that made a commitment to 30% sustainable modes and took 30% of the transport budget to do it, and it happened very dramatically and easily. Copenhagen is still probably the world leader. They reduced car parking 2% a year over 30 years and increasingly just pedestrianised their streets. and made a very attractive city. So car use is now down to 27% for the journey to work. Bikes are 36% and going up. God is green-oriented development, and it's just merely a matter of saying, well, we can't afford to build unless we have green buildings. Treasure Island in San Francisco is going to be a model of a new green city, and the governor is driving a lot of this agenda now. But around the US, lots of cities claim to be the green city. Chicago is saying it, and New York with their green buildings, Seattle saying it. But at least it's on the agenda, the political agenda now, but it has to be built into everything that we do. The Chinese are showing what can be done with Dongtan and Masdar in the Middle East. These are all examples of green-oriented development. Vauban in Germany is the best example I know of how that green building has been mixed with sustainable transport. And the photovoltaics on the roofs, the eco-city that's been built around walking and cycling and light rail. So these kind of developments, BEDZ in London, we know how to do it with commercial buildings now. It's a question of extending it out to all buildings. Electric vehicles are going to be part of this future as well. In the US, I think they're seeing that the electric vehicles are somehow a switch over and all the fossil fuels will disappear and everything will be fixed. But it's not going to be that easy. We do need to have cities that work with good public transport. But even if you've got 50% on public transport, what about the other 50%? That all has to change. And that has to be renewable. The breakthrough has come in the last few years on this, and it is quite dramatic since the lithium-ion battery, what can be done with renewables. We know how photovoltaic's been growing, we know how wind's been growing, can be built into cities, things like wind pods, but how do you store it? And the breakthrough has come in seeing that the storage will be in electric vehicles. Electric vehicles with their lithium-ion batteries, whether they're an electric bus or electric car, electric scooter, can store the electricity that is made from fluctuating renewable energy. And that system is called V2G, vehicle to grid, and it requires a smart grid. It requires the digital systems to make it happen. But we can now have a 100% renewable city. Up until now, you couldn't, with wind and solar, do that because we didn't have the storage mechanisms. So you have this two-way flow. It's now possible to fill up the vehicle at night, and then during the day you plug it in and it feeds back to the grid. The utilities will pay you for that, and there will be this movement both ways. Israel is starting this, Denmark is next, and three Australian cities are starting. If you have a look at Better Place on the web, you'll find out about it. It is a really important development. We have a development with 20,000 residents which will be built along this style. It will be carbon free based on renewables, a smart grid and electric vehicles. But it will also be dense and have public transport at its base. The fringe in the middle suburbs, I think, are going to be under enormous pressure and will need to be recolonised. I think eco-villages are one way that that could happen, where you have a greater self-sufficiency and there is the social supports as well. And finally, travel demand management is part of it. You can't do anything unless we also reduce our need for vehicles. Telepresence is going to grow more and more as a replacement for flying from Australia to America to do a half-hour talk. Travel Smart is one of our contributions. Travel Smart was invented by a German who came to Perth and is now being spread around the world. It's used in the US. There are six cities in the US that are trialling it. It's an individualised marketing approach based on direct intervention with householders. What we're doing now is turning it into Living Smart, which is based on water, waste, energy and travel, and significant reductions are being found. But one of the outcomes is getting kids into walking school buses. That's one of the things that Travel Smart has been pushing. I went to Auckland recently and discovered they've got 200 walking school buses in that that small town. It's remarkable how some things suddenly take off and can be a model. The same you find in Vauban, that essentially the future city can be actually a better place. It can be a place that is a great deal more freedom, where kids can roam like this and not be scared because of cars or stranger danger. This is a city that is built for people as well as being much more ecologically sensitive. So what do we need? We need imagination, we need the black swans, we need post-oil strategies, we need partnerships and stories about those partnerships, and that's what we've got in our book, and we need hope. And certainly that opportunity now is there. Thanks very much.
That was Peter Newman in Vancouver, January 9th, 2009. Peter is no mere theorist. He's headed up sustainable city design in Australia, made big changes, and is now an advisor for a $20 billion fund for a green rebuild of Australia's infrastructure. He is plugged into city designers all over the world and much in demand. You have just heard the complete kickoff speech for his book tour. The title is Resilient Cities, Responding to Peak Oil and Climate Change, just published by Island Press. The book is not an academic deadweight by any means. It's quite user-friendly and compact. You want to skim through it, but you get caught up in the fascinating examples of how we could save our cities despite giant challenges. It hits you where you live. You can download this speech and the previous Radio EcoShock on Transport Revolution by Pearl and Gilbert from our website at ecoshock.org. Select Transportation from our Audio On Demand menu. The whole site is loaded with free MP3 downloads, ecoshock.org. Find out more about Peter Newman and his co-authors, Timothy Beatley and Heather Boyer, at resilientcitiesbook.org. That's resilientcitiesbook.org. Thank you for listening. Here is a bit of David Rovick, The End of the Age of Oil.
It was as if there was a contest to see how many holes could be dug, to see how much of it could be sucked from the ground, to kill off every beetle and bug, to kill off every woman and child, and to kill off every man. And they put it all in barrels, and they put the barrels into cans. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was like a competition to see how big everything could get, from the highways to the strip malls to the giant TV sets, from the Moabs to the drag lines, monster trucks and SUVs, and the massive roaring chainsaws that cut down all the trees. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was like they were trying to see how many garbage dumps they could fill, how many flagpoles could they squeeze onto a single windowsill, how many countries could be bombed, how much black gold could they drill, how much coal could they extract if they just blew up all the hills. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was as if there was some kind of test, and the only way to pass was to turn the planet's atmosphere into a cloud of poison gas. It was like the only thing that mattered was the death of life on Earth. That seemed to be the proof that she had made.